The next case set for argument is appeal number 31118, Jeremy Morris versus Danielle Morris. Eric Slumkin is present, arguing on behalf of the plaintiff appellant, and Robert Trzinka is present, will be arguing on behalf of the defendant appellee. Mr. Slumkin, you may proceed with your argument.
May it please the court. Mr. Chief Justice, counsel. My name is Eric Schlumgen, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Jeremy Morris. I'd like to discuss two issues with the court today as a bit of a roadmap. The first being the circuit court's awarding of attorney fees, treble attorney fees, to Danielle under a theory of abusive process. And second, the circuit court's denial of all of Mr. Morris's causes of action, and ask this court reverse and remand and find that the circuit court enter findings of fact and conclusions of law that are consistent and support the conclusions of law. If the court would like, I'd give a brief factual overview. Otherwise, I will just go into the argument section.
I think we're all well familiar with the facts, but I guess my question for you on those attorney fee issues is it does not appear from the record that any proposed findings or arguments of the nature that you're making now in your brief were submitted to the trial court below. So can we consider them at this stage? And if so, under what is your thought on that?
Yes, Justice. I believe this court is an appropriate court to have review and consideration of that request. And why I say that is I believe attorney fees, whether to award attorney fees or not, under Rush v. Rush, a 2015 decision by this court, to award attorney fees or not award attorney fees, I would say is a question of de novo review. If this court were to consider this in the absence of proposed findings or objections to proposed findings, as this court's held in Selway Homes, Homeowners Association v. Cummings, a 2003 decision, in the absence of either findings of facts proposed or objections, the review of this court would be limited to whether the findings of fact support the conclusions of law. Alternatively, under SDCL 15-6-52 sub A, I would suggest that a clearly erroneous standard exists for when there's error or inconsistency within the findings. Under either of those standards, appellant's position is this court should reverse and remand as there's no basis to uphold the circuit court's conclusions.
Well, the standard of review, I think you've accurately set that forth, but this seems to be more of a preservation issue, whether you preserved the alleged error and can now come in on appeal and argue it when it wasn't presented to the court below.
I think I understand the justice's question that essentially why were proposed findings or objections not filed, and the circuit court at the conclusion of the trial stated the court's likely made its mind up. Findings can be offered or not. The court's cognizant of the costs associated with doing so, and after seeing the findings, there was a decision made by the appellant to preserve the resources of objecting to those findings versus exercising appellate jurisdiction.
But that could have been a fateful decision because the fundamental, these aren't just, sort of, I would say, more technical rules like, you file them, you don't file them, you keep your powder dry for appeal, whatever. The principle that runs through this concept and this topic of preserving error is that you have to give the trial court the first opportunity to rule the way you want the trial court to rule. So they have to have a chance. It has to be teed up for the trial court. That's preserving the error. And if you don't do that, you can't do it for the first time on appeal, regardless of the standard of review.
Justice Salter, our proposition as the appellant in this matter is that this court has a precedent of considering absent any proposed objections or proposed findings by a party, matters entered by the court, the findings of fact and conclusions of law, but it just changes the standard that this court reviews those findings under, and that would be whether the findings of fact support the conclusions of law. I don't believe there's a precedent that this court will not consider any findings of fact. It just changes whether there was objections or proposed findings under what standard this court would review the findings of facts. Moreover, the appellant would argue that this court sua sponte would not uphold findings that were clearly erroneous or that were not supported by the findings of fact. And the position is that the conclusion of the law, number 80, it cites South Dakota follows the American rule for attorney fees. Both sides are responsible for their own fees, citing Stern Oil Company v. Brown, a 2017 decision, and follows that a court may award attorney fees if provided for by statute or contract, and cites SDCL 15-17-38.
Yeah, so objection or not, I'm sorry to interrupt, so objection or not, these are facially wrong. You just read them, and it's wrong, because there's no authority. The rule, the statute doesn't say what the court says it says.
Correct. Facially wrong, and the inconsistencies within the findings of fact do not form a basis to support any of the conclusions of law asserted.
Well, there really are no findings of fact, from what I could tell, period, on the attorney fee award or the compensatory damage award, but with regard to the court's award there. So it appears there were just conclusions of law. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I don't believe there's any findings to support the award of attorney fees, nor to support essentially the bootstrapping of the abuse of process claims as to somehow justify the treble attorney fees that were awarded here. The statute cited in the conclusion of law number 81-15-17-38, the court, if appropriate, in the interest of justice, may award a payment of attorney fees in cases of paternity, custody, and visitation. This case is obviously none of those. So facially, I would say this court relied on the wrong statute, and I would assert that South Dakota has a long jurisprudence of the American rule, and there is no standard by this court that the losing party pay the other litigants' costs. I don't believe that's supported.
So I just want to be clear. Is it your view that you did or did not make that legal objection in front of the trial court? That legal objection to there's no statutory or contractual basis for attorney's fees in this case.
That was not offered as an objection or as a proposed finding to the trial court. That would be correct.
Okay, so now we've got the appeal. How do we review that when there was no objection, legal objection made that there's no contractual or statutory basis to award attorney's fees in this case?
Chief Justice, appellant's position would be that the application of an award of attorney fees, that's a question of law, whether attorney fees are to be provided for or not. And moreover, if this court reviews the standard under whether the findings of fact support the conclusions of law, they do not. And this is
right.
Plainly...
And courts may make legal errors from time to time. If there's no objection, we normally don't review those.
I understand the Chief Justice's point there. I don't believe this court additionally has a basis of affirming plainly erroneous findings or applications of law either. And I would assert this court has the authority either under the review or under a sua sponte theory to state that that is misplaced and it's a misapplication of law.
So you're suggesting some sort of a plain error review. It should have been obvious to the court that this was a legal error.
Yes, and that's what I would assert the legislature imposed in SDCL 15-6-52 sub A, that it's the circuit court's findings must be not plainly erroneous, and these facially were plainly erroneous, that the law relied upon by the circuit court was in fact not supporting any of these propositions. Moreover, I would assert that under the theory of the amount awarded, that quoting Center of Life Church v. Nelson, a 2018 decision, which Justice Salter was the circuit court judge, regarding the award of attorney fees, this court, the function is reviewing the matter that rests in the discretion of the circuit court. It is to protect the litigants from conclusions that exceeds the bounds of reasons. And I would argue this award of attorney fees does exceed the bound of reasons. There is no statutory basis, there's no contractual basis, and how the court came up to treble damages, that's beyond anything that I've seen in the record to support.
Did the court award treble damages? Maybe I'm wrong. I thought the court awarded attorney's fees, and then it awarded twice the attorney's fees as compensatory damages. So yeah, it adds up to three, but it's not one and the same thing, right? Part of it is compensatory, part of it is pure attorney's fees. It's just that the circuit court used the attorney fee number as a benchmark for the compensatories, correct?
Correct, and if I misspoke to that, I did not mean to mislead the court. It would be the $17,000 and then double that, $34,000, and together that would be the $54,000 the court imposed.
So the lack of an objection there could be more problematic because the court has authority. I mean, if the court finds abuse of process and you know, signs findings to that effect, why couldn't the court award some multiple of attorney's fees as compensatory damages in a way that's different than awarding them, you know, as a cost or disbursement under the statute? That may require authority under the American rules that specifically breaks that out from the American rule, but that wouldn't be true for the damages, using attorney's fees as a multiple of damages, would it?
I believe it would, Your Honor, and I respectfully would contest that this is essentially an adaptation of the British system, that where a party tries a case, litigates a case fully, to say that this matter was an abusive process, that something akin to extortion or illegal behavior as a basis of bootstrapping into the amount of attorney fees awarded. There was no Rule 11 safe harbor letter. There was no motion to dismiss. No.
Let's say you're right. Let's say you win on the attorney's fees issue itself. How is that connected to the compensatory damages? The attorney's fees were the attorney's fees, whether he is responsible for them under 15, 1738 or not. Why couldn't that be an item of damages?
Well, there were no findings to support that, and that was not offered as testimony to the court.
I don't think you preserved objections on that. I mean, I understand your argument that the statute doesn't allow attorneys to use them facially. There's something amiss with that. But that doesn't carry over into the compensatory damages very easily, does it?
I would suggest it's all under the same vein and theory that this court, the Supreme Court, has to, you know, in reviewing of the findings, find a legal basis supported by case law and find that there are facts which would support a court's conclusion which was reached here. And I don't believe that's the case. I can continue on with this issue or move to it.
I guess I have a question. So the attorney's fee application was made post-trial. Was there any evidence of attorney's fees offered at trial?
No, there was not an exhibit of attorney fees offered at trial, nor was there testimony. And there's nothing included in the findings of fact as to the amount spent or any, you know, offer of judgment, safe harbor, or anything to that effect to support an appellant's position, the request after the conclusion of the testimony.
And you're objecting to the underlying damages on the abuse of contract claim, but you've not challenged the claim itself, just the underlying damages.
The abuse of process?
The abuse of process, sorry.
Yes, I think it's one and the same, that the damages are stemming or being bootstrapped from the abuse of process, when I don't believe there's any precedent by this court to hold for the proposition that abuse of process can, independent of contract or statute, establish a basis for attorney fees. So I believe the circuit court misplaced the reliance on abuse of process and what damages can stem from abuse of process to reach the award of attorney fees it did reach.
Can you point to anything in the record where you objected to the conclusion that there was an abusive process?
No, and I don't believe that, again, facially, it would be to the appeal to this court that the decision was made, and that decision was to preserve the resources and to preserve the argument to this court, the right of review of the appellate jurisdiction. And I see I'm out of time if I can conclude.
Go ahead.
Can I just follow up on that? Yeah. So your appeal, though, is not challenging the court's finding that there was an abuse of a process. It's solely a challenge to the compensatory damages that were awarded for that claim.
Appellant's
right?
position would be that the attorney fees stem from the abuse of process. There's not a specific section in the appellant's brief objecting to the abuse of process. It would be the attorney fees, and the attorney fees stem from the abuse of process. In conclusion, we would ask this court reverse and remand to the circuit court to enter findings of fact and conclusions of law consistent with the testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Trzinka, you may proceed with argument.
Justice. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Bob Trzinka, and I represent the appellee Danielle Morris in the above entitled matter. I want to start by addressing some of the issues that Justice Devaney raised at the beginning of the appellant's argument, specifically regarding whether the issue of the objection to the attorney's fees was properly preserved for appeal. As this court recognized in the Halbersma v. Halbersma case 2009, South Dakota 98, specifically at paragraph 21, quote, the failure to present an issue to the circuit court presents a bar to review on appeal, unquote. By appellant's own admission, he did not submit an objection to the availability of attorney's fees in an abusive process claim to the circuit court. He did not file objections to the findings of fact, conclusions of law. The first time that he made the argument that attorney's fees are unavailable in an abusive process claim was before this court in his appellant's brief. As such, under the Halbersma decision, which cites the court's underlying jurisprudence of the Nace v. Nace decision, Sioux Falls Shopping News v. Department of Revenue and Regulation, and State v. Olson Lane, all of those cases stand for that proposition that his failure to address that issue with the circuit court does not make that issue available for appeal. As such, justices, I don't believe that the issue of attorney's fees in an abusive process case is properly presented for this court on appeal by the appellant in this matter. Even if they were, the majority rule appears to suggest that attorney's fees are available as a measure of direct damages in abusive process claims.
Can I just clarify, are you making the same argument with regard to the award of attorney fees as a prevailing party, that issue is also not in front of us? Because we have two things.
I would agree.
There's the initial amount because your client prevailed, and then there's the amount that was awarded as compensatory damages. Are you arguing that neither are properly before the court?
That is correct, Justice Feeney. I believe that neither are properly presented before this court. Number one, because the underlying objection to their availability, as I stated before, wasn't properly presented. But then number two, the objection to taxation of costs and disbursements was untimely, and as such, they are considered waived under this court's pre-existing jurisprudence. And I can't remember the case off the top of my head on that, but that is something that we cited in our underlying brief.
So what exception to the American rule can you tell us would entitle your client to attorney's fees here?
Well, the reason is that as the Horn Book on Attorney's Fees recognized that in abusive process claims, they are a unique set of circumstances, much like a Baratree claim, where a party is misusing the court system for some improper purpose. And so the primary damage suffered by the victim of that tort is the attorney's fees that they have had to expend in order to defend themselves from that improper case or the abuse of that process. And so as a direct damage from the abuse of process tort, the attorney's fees are essentially the primary source of damages for the damaged party.
But not, not as a source of damages, but as a prevailing party. And I don't, maybe I misunderstood Justice Kuczynski's question.
That's what I'm getting at.
I understood. I misunderstood your question. I apologize, Justice.
Okay.
Yesterday, and did I pronounce that correctly?
I misunderstand myself all the time. Yeah.
Sorry. I would agree that under the American rule, as a prevailing party issue, generally those damages or generally attorney's fees would not be available in this kind of a case. I think this case, however, is distinct in that the damages of attorney's fees were awarded, and I believe they should have been awarded as direct damages from the abuse of process claim.
So it's a common law rule that would be provide the exception to the American rule?
I think that is a common law rule. That is common law.
And not the 15-17-38 that was utilized?
I don't believe that is the correct statute for that, no. I wouldn't rely on that, no, Justice Salter, at all.
But as far as the prevailing party attorney fees that were ordered by the court, your theory here doesn't appear in the court's conclusions for the prevailing party attorney fee award.
That is correct, Justice Devaney, and I would agree, and what I would contend, however, that is just merely harmless error because those attorney's fees are available as a measure of damages under the abusive process claim. Additionally, with all due respect, Justice, I don't believe that as the court previously noted, that wasn't properly preserved by the appellant in this issue. I would also specifically note for the court that at the time that this case was filed, the plaintiff in this case, Mr. Morris, Jeremy himself had requested attorney's fees, and in the court's conclusions of law, and that's specifically at settled record page 110, there was a note that his request for attorney's fees as the prevailing party was denied. So this is an issue where both parties had requested attorney's fees in this case. The court awarded attorney's fees to defendant. I believe that any issue related to the award of attorney's fees under the standard as the prevailing party, I think is probably harmless error because it's available under the abuse of process claim. And I think there may have just been a clerical issue with whether or not that was properly presented under the abuse of process section or under the final conclusions as to the prevailing party, because Danielle was a prevailing party for the purposes of the abuse of process claim, if that makes sense. The other item that I wanted to specifically address that was raised in the appellant's argument is the concern that there weren't specific findings of fact regarding the attorney's fees award. And while there weren't specific findings of fact in the findings of fact section, there were factual determinations that were made in the attorney's fees section of the conclusions of law, specifically conclusions of law 70 through 77. I think a particular note for this appeal is conclusion of law 77, which addresses how that intersection of the damage incurred by Danielle was directly the result of the improper conduct by Jeremy Morris in bringing the suit. And I'll read that conclusion for the court. Quote, after acknowledging that he signed a gift letter, Jeremy knew he was not entitled to any money from Danielle. He continued the lawsuit to extort money from Danielle as shown by his request for an inappropriate and unsupported amount, which is an improper purpose of the justice system. That squarely falls within the standard of the abuse of process claim, and it would be something where an attorney's fees, again, is the contemplated damage by someone in that position.
So there's what struck me is that the damages, so those were, I agree, findings with regard to finding that they're ultimately concluding there was an abuse of process here. But with regard to damages, there's two paragraphs in the court's conclusions, and it specifically refers to the damages for this tort being tied to emotional distress of your client. And then it cites in a case that refers to those types of damages for emotional distress related to an abusive process. So it just cites, it basically just cites two cases, but then I don't see any application of either of those principles to facts pertaining to an emotional distress resulting from the filing and having to defend in this lawsuit.
The fixed decision, which coincidentally Mr. Moorhead, who was in the appeal just prior to this, was the one of the attorneys who tried the fixed case. The fixed decision agrees that there you can have emotional distress damages in an abusive process case. The question then becomes what needs to be documented in order to have emotional distress damages or how it is applied. And there is no clear-cut standard, and I don't believe that there's any case law from this court requiring that there be specific findings of fact regarding the type or measure of the underlying emotional distress damages.
But there's
go ahead, I'm sorry.
There's no findings at all, though. I mean, so then the court, we have these two paragraphs that cite these two cases, and then at the end, under the order part, the court just says the defendant is awarded compensatory damages for emotional distress, and then list the amount. So where are there any findings that tie, you know, emotional distress related to the abusive process claim to justify a compensatory damage? And I agree, I don't disagree at all with anything you're saying about the cases, but I just don't see any application of that to facts here.
I would agree that there isn't direct application of the facts to the law for emotional distress damages in the court's findings, fact, conclusions of law and order. I would indicate that I don't believe that there is any case law that states that that is a requirement of the court. Frequently, when this court is addressed with emotional distress challenges in, for example, a jury trial, the jury trials don't make specific factual determinations as to what types of emotional distress damages a person suffered. The only thing that is entered for an emotional distress damages case is the dollar value of the emotional distress damages.
It's just where I was going, actually. I think that if we indulge for a minute the idea that that's where we're at in this case, and I don't know, we haven't decided that, but if we say that's where we're at in this case, no findings, no objections, we have this very limited review of determining whether the facts were correctly applied, it does seem a lot like reviewing a general verdict in some ways, right? There's no deep dive into discrete findings and conclusions as you would have if it had been, you know, the product of the adversarial system operating at a more optimal sort of pitch. So the question then is there evidence in the record of emotional damages?
Yes, Justice Salter. I believe that the trial court, in reviewing the trial court, Danielle testified about how difficult that process was for her, the effect that it had on her, that it was a very challenging...
The breakup or the lawsuit?
The lawsuit, the entire process, because keep in mind that the court made a specific factual finding of extortion regarding the abuse of process claim. And I think that in and of itself is evidence that this court could consider as part of an underlying basis for emotional distress damages.
More fundamental, though, as you talk about the evidence in the case, I understand non-economic loss, you know, sometimes that's hard to quantify, and so witness gets up and says, here's my emotional distress, and I get that, it's hard to quantify. But the court actually did something different here. The court actually said, I'm going to award attorney's fees. There was no evidence presented of attorney's fees at trial. So how does that get into the record that the court can make that finding and say, I'm going to award you double attorney's fees when there's no evidence of attorney's fees presented at trial?
Well, And that's sort of typically how these attorney's fees issues frequently are addressed.
But this isn't the same kind of attorney's fee issue where you're doing post-trial and you've got a contract or you've got some legal basis to request attorney's fees. This is actually awarding them as damages as a part of the cause of action. Don't you have to put those into evidence at trial to be able to get those?
Well, I would suggest, with all due respect, the fact that the attorney's fees are there, part of the trial itself is part of the damages that were suffered, and as such, the attorney's fees damages
aren't fully... Right, but how does the court even know what those are if those aren't introduced at trial?
Well, and that's why I think it's subject to post-trial objections and briefing, which was not done in this case.
In order to probably get at that question, you'd almost have to sort of the Chief Justice's, it's almost as if you'd have to interpret, and I don't know if it could or not, but it's almost as if you'd have to interpret the post-trial affidavits and application for costs as effectively an effort to reopen the evidentiary record.
That is a good way to examine it, Justice Salter, and I think...
I don't know if it is. I just thought about it, but maybe it's not good. I don't know.
Well, and along those lines, I think the way that the court should probably think about it is much like how we deal with bifurcation of compensatory damages from punitive damages, frequently in cases of intentional torts or those kind of cases, where in an abuse of process claim where you have an underlying injury, which is the attorney's fees, that attorney's fees issue is then bifurcated from the underlying case with subsequent litigation.
But that's not what we have on this record. We don't have a bifurcated trial. We don't have a motion to reopen the case and say, hey, here's our attorney's fees, judge, can you consider those as damages? We don't have anything in the trial record.
That's correct. That was all done by motion and affidavits after the case.
So isn't it speculative then? Damages cannot be speculative. I understand you can't ascertain them with precision, especially when it comes to emotional distress. But if a judge orders double damages for emotional distress without knowing what the damages, without knowing what the attorney's fees are, I'm sorry, double attorney's fees without knowing what they are. Isn't that speculative?
I see my time has expired. May I answer?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I don't think that it's speculative, and here's the reason why. Number one, as this court recognized in the McKee case, there just has to be some underlying reasonable basis for those attorney's fees. And in this case, when you have an abuse of process claim, a good basis or an anchor for those attorney's fees for the emotional distress damages is the attorney's fees, because it is the most concrete measure of the actual damage suffered by, or the concrete damage suffered by the victim in the case. Thank you, Chief Justice. Thank you, Court.
Thank you. Mr. Schlumgen, you may proceed with your rebuttal.
Mr. Schlumgen, if I could just jump in quick. As you were departing after your earlier remarks, I thought I heard you say that you were asking us to remand the court to make or to enter some findings. And that was not what I had kind of penciled in for the requested relief that you were seeking. I had that you were on all of these issues seeking outright reversal and victory on appeal. Am I wrong?
It would be enter findings consistent with the testimony given. So the testimony would relate, the findings of fact would relate to the record, and I don't think you're wrong. I think it's, we would contend that would be, if the facts were reflective of what was concluded, I believe that would be correct.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, do you agree that the failure to object and submit your own findings has consequences to the scope of our review in this appeal?
Correct. I do not disagree with that.
And so the relief you're seeking would be then to go back down and redo findings and then allow you to participate in that process on remand?
Correct.
But you didn't the first time, so that wouldn't be very consequential at all.
I think it would be consequential in the sense that it's a massive deterrent of anyone to go through this exercise of not utilizing those rights, and this is no way to award an appellant who failed to do so. This is to ensure that the court's order complies with the jurisprudence of this court. And I think that's what needs to be done as an order, regardless of whether findings were submitted or not. This court's review is whether the findings of fact support the conclusions of law.
Here's the concern I have. And this happens all the time at different levels, for trial, during trial, after trial. Somebody says, I'm raising the white flag. We're just not litigating anymore. And typically they try to settle it. It seems like, there's this email in the file from you that says, yeah, my client told me not to submit findings and conclusions. It seems like you're raising the white flag at that point. And I'm having a hard time understanding how you even appeal at that point.
Your Honor, we would contend that's not a waiver. It's more of a preservation of resources as to what court will be reviewing.
Right, but if you're going to spend all this time on an appeal, why not make sure you've got a good record and a basis to actually challenge the issues that you want to challenge on appeal?
I would refer to Justice Salter's answer of that might be the most beneficial way to navigate this adversarial system. That's what was not done here.
And it might be the only way under our cases.
Appellant would still assert that the findings of fact must support the conclusions of law, especially when the conclusions of the law are made without any supporting precedent. And to Justice Devaney's question regarding the emotional distress, those were claims made by Danielle Morris, which were stipulated to be dismissed regarding the intentional and then the negligent infliction of emotional distress. There was not testimony here to support emotional distress, and there was not a basis of how that emotional distress and the effects of it correlate to the attorney fees awarded. There's no case law that the damage for being a litigant in a lawsuit should result in attorney fees. That's essentially the adaptation of the British system, that by being a litigant and having to go through a lawsuit just because you win, the prevailing party statute for costs does not include attorney fees. It's disbursements. It's not attorney fees. There's no basis before this court's precedent to support that, and this is
What was the basis that you had saw attorney's fees in the circuit court? What basis was that based upon, or what source was that based upon?
To that specific pleading of what it was included in the complaint, as I stand here today, I can't tell the court why that basis would be made. I would agree there's no statutory or contractual basis for that, so I don't know if that was pled out of an abundance of caution and would be not included, but as before this court, the circuit court's findings are unsupported by any doctrine of this court. It's essentially the adaptation that a party that contests a fully litigated legal argument colorable under law, if they win, they now get to seek attorney fees. I see my time's concluded. There's no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this morning. The case is fully submitted.